You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My name is Paul D. Irvin, born November 12, 1934, in Cincinnati, Ohio, born at St. Mary's Hospital, and I think it was about 5 o'clock in the morning.
Paul Irvin is a beloved husband, father, and grandfather. He's lived a life full of grit, heart, and purpose. Born in Cincinnati in 1934, he grew up alongside three older sisters, spent his days playing baseball with friends, and worked a myriad of different jobs. He stepped up early in life to help support his single mom and eventually joined the Air Force. His time in the service took him to Texas, Alaska, and eventually Madison, Wisconsin, where he met his wife, Fran. The two built a beautiful life together. They raised two incredible daughters, both high-level swimmers. Paul has spent the majority of his career at the Department of Transportation, where his knack for problem solving really shines. He's lived in the same home since 1965, and even after losing his sweetheart Fran, Paul has stayed active, grounded, and full of stories worth telling.
My mother's name was Ethel Virginia Whitaker, is her maiden name, and my dad's name was Paul Wesley Irvin. And he was born in 1899, where my mother was born in 1909. I have three sisters. The first one was Ethel Virginia Irvin, named exactly after my mother. She was born in 1924. So that, as you notice, that 1909 and then 1924, you know, she's probably about 15 years old. The reason why that probably happened, she got married because Eva was the first, and then my mother, Ethel, and there was a set of boy twins, which was John and Lawrence, and then there was a set of girl twins, which was Mary and Jean. So there were six kids. My grandmother died in 1924, and my grandfather died in 1922. So that means they were out without parents. They were in West Virginia, and my mother lived on River Street. My dad really lived on River Street, too, just a couple of doors down. And so, of course, you notice how old he is, right? 10 years older than my mother. And he was in the war, World War II, World War I also, but World War II, Merchant Marines, and he was the captain of the ship. And so the only thing I can recollect is what happened was when he got on furlough, and my mother got pregnant every time, right? And so that was the last one out of my three sisters, which I was born in 34. And so the last time I seen him was when I was 10 years old. He came home on furlough from World War II. So that's the last time I seen him and never seen him again, ever. And he never, when he got discharged after the war in 1944, 45, their area, instead of coming home and supporting his family, he actually boarded another cargo ship and as a bosun's mate. My two sisters, they were in the Navy in World War II also. They got discharged. One of them, Ethel, she, the oldest one, came home to Cincinnati. My second oldest stayed in California and got her degree being a teacher. And also, to the grapevine, I heard that she met my father there. And that's the last time she saw him, was there. So my mother divorced him when I was 12 years old. Then she married a stepfather, I think a couple of years later. And so we had a lot of fun with our mother. She was really a nice person. Disciplined, of course, very tough woman to be able to do that. We were poor, and so my mother only had one bed. Well, all four of us was in one bed. But I was very young, you know, with my three sisters, because they're much older than I am. And so then a lot of times we would, certain times of the week, there was this one station on the radio. We didn't have TV, just the radio. And we turned on the Philco radio. It was Inner Sanctum Mysteries was the one we loved so much. We would turn off all the lights and jump back into bed and listen to this scary howling wolves and squeaking doors and all this stuff. Then use your imagination what's happening. During Christmas, we would do our own Christmas stuff, you know, like we'd string popcorn and put candles on the tree, which was dangerous as can be. We had no light stove. Second oldest, Pauline, their sister, she always was the best fudge maker, and she made the best fudge. And my mother made, you know, always made good food and pies and stuff like that, too. So we had no money to buy presents and stuff like that. And my mother always made sure we had food on the table. And I mean, not a lot, because she had to work and also I had somebody to take care of me and the children. And when they were younger, of course, as we've grown up. And my oldest sister, her personality was more mild type person, you know, very loving, mild person, doesn't get upset, doesn't get angry about anything. And so she was very pleasant. And then my second, Pauline, she was tough. She's a good, great athlete. She could play baseball and anything. And all the boys wanted her on the team too, because she was always good at everything. I remember her for this one time, she came home with a black eye. My mother said, "Where'd you get that black eye?" She says, "Well, I got into a fight with a couple of guys." And she says, "Did you get punched in the eye?" "Yeah, I got punched in the eye, but I got back at them." And she did them in. So it's a pretty tough girl. And she was a good artist, like drawing animals. And my third oldest, Doodles, Ruth, sister, youngest of the three, she was good at dancing, very good at dancing. She could do any type of dancing that was out there, new, old, whatever. And she was good at roller skating, too, and also ice skating.
Having been born in 1934, Paul remembers what life was like growing up during World War II.
During the war, I was probably 8, 9, 10. But we had air raids during World War II, and we had to pull the shades, turn lights out, hit the floor when they had that, because we had a lot of industry there. We were rationed, you couldn't get things. You couldn't get shoes. You couldn't get sugar. You had so many, you had stamps and tokens to get certain things. And then we had Fountain Square downtown. And that's where, when the war ended, that's where we all went down there and just had a ball, just happy. Everybody was happy and jumping around. That was a really good time. As a boy, I always played baseball, and I was really good at baseball because I played it every day in my life. On Renner Street in Cincinnati, there was a rocky field. It was rocks. It was called a rocky field, and the fruit trees would grow out there, and peaches and wild stuff, but also fruit tree, apples and stuff like that. We would have our games out there, set up our bases and everything, and so we're out there, and then the mothers would be calling us in for supper, right? One would be whistling for the kid, and the other one would be yelling for the kid, and whatever way they got you to come over to eat. And so we'd run home, eat, and bang, right back out there again, playing baseball. So we were very, very athletic and competing against each other. Who can do this? How many steps does it take to go across that street? Who can do the least steps? Or an alley? Who can jump the alley? Stuff like this, how young boys do. And my sister had Dolly, was her name, dog, a little tiny female dog. And she had puppies, about 8 puppies. And this one, I selected one to keep. So I kept Whitey, was the name of Whitey. And they were rat terriers. And so I had a brewery in my neighborhood. And, where there's brewery, you got rats, right? And so my dogs, they kill rats. The mother would chase the rat, and then she would stop, and then the son would get the rat. Of course, they kill the rat, and just play with it for a while. Yeah. And then, of course, you have these big cockroaches that fly, because then that's another thing, a brewery, right? So they're it's kind of weird having a brewery in the neighborhood, right? But it was kind of neat. And in the summertime, the brewmaster, he opened up the double doors, and it would be hot outside. The summertime, the steam would be coming out of the door. And he had a big old vast of beer that just got brewed, and he was drinking it. And then we were all down there looking up at him, and then he came down and gave us a sip of beer. And it was good because it was the right temperature. That was the best tasting beer I ever tasted in my life, other than Guinness, because I do like Guinness beer, draft. And then my buddy, this house was right there on that corner, and his mother came out. Oh, my. She was a real nice woman, though, because she always made me toasted tomato sandwiches with butter on it, fresh tomatoes with Hentosa and butter. And we had a good old time at their house. We played cards and all kinds of games. He'd always played something. You know, we didn't sit still. We was always moving, doing something. And we made a lot of things like scooters of ourselves and rifles with the old inner tubes and with a clothespin. And you would shoot the rubber inner tube because you would actually stretch it and then the clothespin would hold it. And then you release it, and then you shoot it. Very inventive. We did that. And plus, we played Mumbly Peg. It's with a knife, a pocket knife. And what you do, you have a ground, you know, of earth. And then you'd actually take the knife and you hold the blade on like your elbow. And you flip the knife. And then it's got a stick in the ground. And the one that didn't, they lose. So then you do it on your knee. Your knees, and you go all over your body, on your shoulder, all this kind of stuff, crazy stuff. That's another little game we played, Art the Gang.
The fun of Paul's childhood continued on into his teenage years.
We had a lot of girls. Also, we had a lot of house parties. We'd play Spin the Bottle and stuff, then dance. We had record players and we danced and all that kind of stuff. So that was kind of fun, you know, going to different people's houses too. We went to dances. Big orchestras would come to like Buddy Morrow, Stan Getz, and we had music hall there. They had dances there. We'd go and also Coney Island with the rides and the swimming, a big swimming pool. And then they had Moonlight Gardens, and that's where the dancing was. So in other words, you were dancing underneath the stars, and that was kind of neat. Of course, we had a great zoo, too. We went to the zoo a lot.
From a young age, Paul has been a hard worker. He's had just about every job in the book and has lots of interesting stories from these experiences.
Well, when I was a boy, you know, I would do anything to make money, except I wouldn't do anything about stealing or anything like that, but I sold papers on the corner. Also, German-made pretzels, soft, like three in a bag for 15 cents. And then the newspaper, you know, you stand on the corner and say, extra, extra, read all about it, you know, like the old times, how they sold papers off the corners. As 11 years old, I was sitting pins at a bowling alley, and I actually had to take a bus to get there. And I got my own Social Security card. I'd be sitting at two alleys. And you had to pick up the pins, the 10 pins you had to pick up, but your hands, there was no automatic, and then throw them into the compartment in the cage, and you press it down to the floor with the triangle. That was hard work because those pins were heavy, but you pick up, you know, two in each hand. I'm 11 years old, you know, doing this. Then you got to worry about the timing, because if you don't, they're going to throw a ball. You better get out of that alley because you're going to get hit with those pins. So that made money that way. My buddy and I, Dave Shelton, which is Nicole's godfather, we came up with this idea, you know, A&P shopping and Kroger shopping. So what will you do? He had this big, huge baby buggy. I don't know where he got it from. But the thing was almost as big as a truck. And we could hold three kids in there. Yeah, the big one. Now, I had a wagon. So then, you know, women went to shopping, right? But how are they going to get home? Did they have a car? No, they walked. So we stood outside of the store, and as they walked out, you want us to help you take your groceries to your house? And then, of course, they paid. You know, we didn't say how much, and it is whatever they gave us, you know, like that. So if we did that for a long time. And another thing, on this hill in Cincinnati, they got these weeds that actually forest like them, like a cone type thing, but when they're dried, and they use that in some forest arrangements. So we knew this too. So what do we do? When they all were dormant and you know, turning brown and everything like that, we get up there cutting them. So we'd get you get a quarter for 100 of those. So that we made money that way too. Oh, yeah. Then I worked another thing. I worked at the Catholic churches. I wasn't Catholic, but I worked at this one church for bingo, selling stuff for the church. But then they paid me, of course, you know, for doing that. I also worked in a bakery. I baked pies and stuff like that. And then I worked in a punch press operator as a teenager. And that was dangerous. You got some mechanism, whatever shape you're going to be punching out of this metal. And so when you press the pedal, the device comes down and actually cuts into the metal and shapes it. And it's piecework. So you got to, you know, the more you produce, the more you get paid, right? So you want to be fast. So then the guy that was training me, I had three fingers missing. So I did that. And I was a switchman on a railroad at age 18 before I went in the Air Force. That was dangerous work there. Very dangerous. No, I'm talking to the engineer with a lantern, you know, telling him to stop, slow down, back up, bop, bop, like that. Whenever I throw the switch, all the tracks to a different location, I have to throw the track. So that was that job there. There's another one I did too, was making patterns, wooden patterns, cover up big generators or maybe a water valve, a big water valve or something. We would actually develop that thing out of wood, and then you press that into the sand and then pour the metal or whatever into the sand and form it. This thing was huge. So then I also cooked paint too. I did that too at the Ohio Chemical Company. And that was a third shift job. The paint, you had to cook. So you had to put all the products, the chemicals, you had to actually cook it inside these big vats. You would have to test it to see if it was done. So you would reach down with a spatula and in there and scoop up a little bit and both fall in there because it's a huge thing.
Paul was dedicated to helping support his mom and sisters, which led him to leave school, continue working, and eventually took him to the Air Force.
I quit school. I was in the 10th grade, and I quit half semester at that time. I got tired of my mom, you know, buying me things and all this, had to support. And so I felt like I better get to work. But I was a B student when I did, you know, quit. So I just lucked out and got into the Air Force. Well, here's what happened. When I was 17, all my buddies and I joined the Air Force all at the same time. Seven of us from Cincinnati, very good friends. So we did a 250 question to find out, what is your career going to be, you know, in the Air Force? So then I come to find out, when I had my physical, the doctor looked at my ears, and my right ear, I have a perforated eardrum from birth. And I don't know what happened, but that's what I had, the hole in my eardrum. And so it was draining at that time. And so then the doctor said, were you swimming? And so I said, no. And so that's why I didn't get in. Probably if I said yes, you know, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. And so then I went to an ear doctor, and he actually looked in there and lanced my ear. And when he did that, of course, I woke up on the floor, passed out, because that, you know, the pain is so great, you don't even know it, so you just knock out. And so then I had a buddy that comes home on furlough. So I went out with him. He says, I was 19 at this time. He said, why don't you just try again? You know, I got brothers in the Air Force and down in San Antonio at Lackland, where you get your basic training. I got three brothers who are master sergeant. You have a maid there, you know? So I believed him. So then I went and did my test again with 250 questions and then passed the physical, which is a miracle. And I got in the Air Force in 1953 when I was 19. So then it was December 1, 1953. I went to boot camp in San Antonio through Christmas. And the first time I'd ever been away from home, which I was pretty well homesick by that time. And especially being in boot camp, they're really, you know, pushing on you, you know, really chewing you out and things like this. And always try to do the best I could and do everything, follow everything, all the commands and everything, do everything that's told to me, which I did. I had one TI. He was really, really, he was good, but not as good as this second. We got this second one. That was a Marine, an ex-Marine that became our TI, actually. And he sort of took a liking to me. He made me the top person in the flight that everybody would dress to me. I was the one that set the pace and everything like that. And so then when we graduated in the Air Force, then there was always somebody that kind of had to carry the flag. He wanted me to carry the flag, and I just didn't want to do that. I'm just not that type of guy that wanted to be the standout, you know what I mean? And he got so mad at me, you know, that again, I wouldn't do it. And so he comes to me after I got my stripe, my one little stripe, private. And so then he says, I want you to take charge of my group. And so I felt that he really took a liking to me about it because I did everything right. And then finally, I got my assignment to go to Fort Worth, Texas, Carswell Air Force Base, where the home of the B-36 bombers, which these bombers had six reverse props, three on each wing. It was the bomber they used to keep Russia in check. And we had about 30 of those bombers on that base. Well, my job was to check out Remington Rand computers. It wasn't computers at that time. It was board wiring. And so then, okay, then two other guys. So four of us were at the black hangar on the flight line. No air conditioning at all. 110 degrees out there on the flight line and frogs jumping everywhere out there. And so we had to make it work. And what we did, we took care of all the maintenance on all the B-36s for being able to fly. So that was our job. And we had to make this Remington Rand equipment do the job. And then we didn't know, but they were also testing out IBM at that time. So it was what we were going to, which one we're going to choose, you know, Remington Rand or IBM. We busted our butts to make it work because it was so hot and the cards would jam and, you know, all this stuff like that because the humidity was there. And so we made it work. But we spent many hours doing it, like sleeping on the table, you know, overnight. So it was all finalized and come to find out that they chose IBM, what the Air Force did, chose the IBM equipment. When that happened, then Remington Rand, actually, the CE, the customer engineer, came and jerked out all the equipment because they were mad because the Air Force chose IBM. So what do you think? You think we were done? No, we weren't done. We didn't have the equipment, but we had to do it manually by charts. So we had to chart it because we had things going that they relied on us for these certain B-36s we were maintaining. So I learned IBM, and then I was in the Air Force for 4 years plus 4 years out. And so then I was attached to Conrad for those other 4 years after I got discharged. Then they said, where do you want to go overseas? So I chose probably Italy, Germany, or some place like that, you know, three different places. Lo and behold, what do I get? Alaska. And so then I went to Alaska in 1954-ish. And so I was there for a year and a half there. And by that time, I made buck sergeant. So I had three striper at that time. So then, first I went to Seattle, and then I was waiting for a ship. I was in Seattle for about a month, and no ship, Pier 91, and no ship. So finally, they decided to, we're going to fly us up, and flew up the military plane into Anchorage, Alaska, which I didn't know what I was getting into, but as you fly into Anchorage, it's like a bowl of mountains. And it was like, I'm flying in there, and all of a sudden, I see where I could be living with these little Quonset huts, little oval-shaped metal barracks-like with the stovepipe with smoking coming out of it. You know, I said, what in the heck is there going to have the equipment in this place, right? And so then flying it there, and here, lucky enough, there was a big blue barracks, concrete. So That was nice to know. So then I spent almost a year and a half there. And the first year I was there was 310 inches of snow, a record, of course. We had to dig our way out of the barracks. And once the snow started, which would be in September, you never saw the ground again until summer. There was no four seasons there. While I was in Alaska, I actually was on the team that developed transceiving and received data. Instead of going TDY, you know, teletype, it was actually transceive, receive, radio, and also telephone. Yeah, because the reports and to order supplies, you had to transmit this data some way. So it used to be TDY on a punch tape, and you take it down to the TDY, and then they would transfer it to all the locations where you're ordering parts for airplanes or blah, 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 you know. So we actually developed the telephone line, which the radar sites which sent in all the data to us at Anchorage, the home base, was all in top secret. You had to be cleared for that, of course. So then we developed that, and it was amazing because we had a radio under the ocean. That was radio. Telephone was telephone line, of course. And you get a crack even over the ocean, and then your data would, let's say you had a 200 IBM card you were transmitting, and it was only 50 made it. So they'd have to start all over again because you got a crack or a storm in the ocean or whatever. That would stop transmission. You have to start back over again. You send 100 cards, you've got to say, oh, I got 100 cards, received it, sent it, okay, match, got it. It's kind of neat to be able to develop that, you know, that system. So that was quite an experience and a learning factor, how to do that. And in the Air Force, you know, we usually play a lot of cards, you know, they play blackjack, stuff like that. So I send all my money I won to my mom, and she saved it for me. And then I also saved enough money where if I'm going to come back and rotate back, I'm going to fly back commercial air, not military air. So I paid my old ticket to go back. So then I flew back to Seattle and landed and kissed the ground. But because at that time, Alaska was not a state at that time. I got overseas pay there. And then I said, well, okay, I'm going to catch the train, the Hiawatha, this real fancy train with a dome on the top, you know, and stuff like that. So jumped on the train and drove that all the way to Chicago. And then had to change trains there because the Hiawatha doesn't go to Cincinnati. So I had to take like a cattle car from luxury to a piece of junk. from Alaska, after I, you know, came home to Cincinnati, and then I got my orders where my next place is, and that was for Madison, Wisconsin. They told me there's no equipment there, no IBM equipment there. And I said, well, how am I going to do my job? When I came here, they just started the installation at Truex Field. So we started there, and we only had to work about an hour a day, because once we got the mark sensing cards, that all the supplies we had to order, and then we'd take that down to supplies, and they would ship it out to what we had to get, you know, for Truex Field. So that was our job. That was about an hour a day, and then the rest of the time we're playing either chess in the back room or pinochle or whatever, you know. So it's kind of neat. And I was a tree striker, which is a buck sergeant, and then I had two staff sergeants was ahead of me, and then we had one guy was an airman third. But we all had to clean everything. We had to scrub the floors, you know, and stuff like that. We didn't push it all on that airman third guy. So it's kind of neat that I got to be a staff sergeant. Within 4 years, it's almost impossible to get staff sergeant.
It was around this time in Madison that Paul met Frances Fiore, a beautiful, dark-haired Catholic Italian girl, the love of his life.
In the meantime, I met my wife, Frances Fiore, at a blind date. She wasn't my blind date. It was another girl that was my blind date. She was kind of tall for me. So then I danced with Fran, even though she was with another guy. I danced with her, got her phone number. When I first met her, I was attracted to her. When I left and went back to the base, then I called her the next day, talked to her. I says, I had to give you some information about the guy you were with. That this guy was married. She says, what? I said, yeah, but I'm not married, and I'd like to go out with you. So sure. So then we were together until she passed away. So she was probably 19. She was working at DMV downtown, Department of Motor Vehicle, which I was picking her up every day. After I got off of work, then I'd go and pick her up that downtown and take her home. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to see her, because in an Italian family, girls, they're like, I got to take her out one time a week. That was it. One day. We're in by midnight. So what she would do, she would go babysitting and she'd have me come over. So I got to see her more than one day a week. But at night, a lot of times I'd go and her window was way up there on the second floor. And I'd throw little pebbles up the window and then she'd come out on the porch and we'd talk. You know, of course, you couldn't come down because it's up above the dining room. There was a porch on top of the dining room up there with railings around it. But her door opened to that. We went dancing and everything like that. And we parked a lot and kissed and smooched and drank a lot of coffee and talked a lot, you know, about how many kids we'd have and stuff like that. Yeah, we did a lot of parking. But we were always good. I mean, my wife was a solid Catholic. She went to Catholic grade school and high school, graduated in 1955 from Edgewood High School, and she was a good Christian, I'll tell you. And so I wasn't Italian, right? Number one, that's one strike. I wasn't Catholic, that was number two, and I was in the Air Force, it was number three. So that's a no-no right there, right? Three. But the mother was okay with it, but the father wasn't. So, yeah, that's the way it went. I proposed, we were We were at the Capitol Theater in Madison, and I had the ring in my pocket, a ring case in my front pocket. We went to the show, and Frank Sinatra, the movie All the Way, and so we're there, and I had an arm around her in the seat, and everything like that. And then when we're leaving, I got up, and she got up and embraced her, and they said, "What's it in your pocket?" And I pulled it out, and I said, "Will you marry me?" And this stuff right there at the Capitol Theater. We were already engaged when I was in the Air Force. In fact, he sewed my staff sergeant stripes on my uniform, took off the buck sergeant. So then what I did, I became a Catholic at the time. I was engaged to her, bought her a ring for $105 at Goodman Jewelry's. I mean, it was a good diamond, but it was a small little diamond. And my mother did not like that. She said, "Why didn't you get it? Why didn't you make him give you a bigger diamond than that?" I was only making $60 a month in the Air Force, being a staff sergeant even. And that's all I could afford, you know. So I was paying $5 a month or whatever it was for the ring. And you know, she loved that ring, though.
During their courtship, Paul was discharged from the Air Force and had two important things to take care of: tie up some loose ends in Cincinnati, and find a job in Madison.
Of course, I got discharged December 1, 1957. When I got discharged, I went back to Cincinnati. Of course, see my mom. So then I told her, you know, I'm coming back to Madison because I met this girl, and we get married. I was going with this girl before, and so then I had to break off with her. And so then this girl worked at the telephone company, the one in Cincinnati, and her name was Bertie. And the funny thing about this, because I'd be talking to my wife, my future wife, a long time on the phone from Cincinnati. And at that time, you had to put money in the telephone, right? And when your time was up, they would come on and say, you know, put more money in if you want to talk more, whatever. Yeah. It never ran out. We were talking for hours on the phone. So the only thing I could think of, she knew it was me on the phone, Bertie, that worked for the telephone company, so she let it slide. That's the only thing I can think of. And then finally, I came back to Madison after a couple of weeks, you know, missing her and everything. So I came back. My mother actually got me a car, so I had a car when I came back to Cincinnati after I got discharged. It was a 1937 Black Buick, and I drove back to Madison and, of course, looking for a job, and nobody was ringing. Here I had 4 years of, you know, this board wiring and everything, every machine, I get board wire, everything, calculators, everything, printers. Nobody was, even 4 years, you know, experience, top grade, you know, I could do anything. So I'm walking down the Park Street by UW, and I seen this building. It looked like a house, but then I saw there was equipment in there, you know, that I work on. So I go in there, and I walk in, and I go in there, and it says, "Hey, you know what? This is my type of work. I've been doing this for 4 years in the Air Force, blah, blah, blah." And he hired me right off the street. And so that was a limited term, you know, 6 months limited term, because it was a state job. It was for the university, but it's a classified civil service job. So you had to take a test, you know, to become certified. And so then they did the payroll, the budget, the inventory for the university. So that was kind of interesting. And my 6 months was coming up. So then if I wanted to stay, I had to take the test. And I was sweating it, because if you don't pass, you don't get the job. So I'm sweating it, and I got the job. So that was very nice.
August 8th, 1959. Marked the beginning of a beautiful 64-year marriage between Paul and Fran.
We got married in 59, August the 8th, and hotter than the Dickens. It was a beautiful wedding, though. So we got married at the Queen of Peace Church, Catholic Church. My mom and my stepfather came, and my buddy David Shelton and his wife, Barbara Shelton. We had four groomsmen and four bridesmaids and the whole nine yards. And when we got married, the priest, you know, as you give each other the rings, you know, and put them on their finger, I was reaching. He said, "Now you can place the ring on her finger," you know. So I reached and the man, I was going to put hers on first, right? Okay. And then she put mine on mine, right? So what I do, I pick up mine, and I tried to put that on their finger, and the priest had to grab my hand and shake it. That was funny. And I was so nervous about it, you know. and stuff like that, and happy. And so that was really wonderful. So that, yeah. Of course, you always put flowers at Virgin Mary's statue in church, and it's always a ceremony of that. And that was quite nice, and all the relatives were there. And we had a reception at Amato's on Park Street. The restaurant was an Italian restaurant, and it was quite nice, the reception there, because it was $1.50 a meal, family style, all you can eat, chicken, and they had dancing, this, everything. It was really, really fun. A lot of pictures, a lot of memories. And then we went to their home, my wife's parents' home, and then they had the get-together after that, you know, which we normally do, you know, drinking and partying and talking and having fun. Well, we're getting ready to leave, right? Getting our suits. I got my suit on, she got her going-away dress on, and hopped in the car and said adios. And they kept on partying. I mean, the Italian family was just wonderful people. And we paid for our own wedding, really. And it was not that expensive, but the gifts that they paid for the wedding, and so we went on our honeymoon. What, this isn't a big deal, right? But we didn't have much money, you know, or anything like that. And we took off and for Cincinnati on our route. Well, we went to Milwaukee first, and then we went to Cincinnati after that. And I took her to Beverly Hills in Kentucky. There was a club named Beverly Hills, where they have floor show and a dining, you know, a dinner and everything like that. Like you would see Frank Sinatra or something like that. But it was in Covington, Kentucky. And so then we had to go across the bridge to get there from Cincinnati, Ohio. So all of a sudden we go downtown, and it was at night, and there was a big commotion down there. Come to find out, there was a guy, he was up on top of the bridge, and he was going to jump. That was quite a commotion.
Pretty quick, the two lovebirds settled into newlywed life.
Yeah, we lived at 4228 Lundy Road, apartment above a garage. $100 a month was the rent. And it was furnished, though, too. It was kind of nice. And so then we lived there from 1959 to 1965. I bought a 1959 Mercury. Big boat. I mean, that thing was a mile long. So then we were friends with this couple that my wife went to school with, and we would go out with them, and we'd come over and play cards. And this one night, about 1 o'clock in the morning, we said, why don't we go to Chicago and get a pizza or chicken or whatever? And so we hop in the car, and we're driving Chicago, and it's darker than get out. 2 o'clock in the morning. We're hitting there about 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning, right? Or 4, whatever it was. We couldn't find a place even open. Finally, we found one place. And we went there, and we had a little meal, and we drove back. We laughed all the way. I'll tell you, that was the most funniest trip. And we always reminisced about that. Yeah, we just spent a lot of time with that couple, Mary and Franti.
About 6 years into their marriage, Paul and Fran built the house that would become their forever home.
We built our house in 1965, is when we, from 59 to 65, then we moved into our brand new house on 765 Odena Lane, a ranch house, and my wife didn't want to leave. I wanted to leave a long time ago to buy another house, but no, she didn't want to do it, so every time it came up, I said, oh, man, I want to move. I like it here. Of course, I made it you know, with flowers and shrubs and everything, and the pond and the fish, and made a lot of brickwork outside. You know, like paths around the house is bricked. Don't have any grass up against my house whatsoever. It's stoned all around. And then flowers everywhere, every type of daylily you can think of. And I added a family room on off of the kitchen. We remodeled this 15 years ago. And, you know, the cabinets and the floors, and it worked out fine. But with my girls, their bedrooms are close together down the hall. Nicole's room had double windows side by side. Jackie's had two different windows, one on the right side, one on the left side. So what they do, they got initiative in their brain. They want to talk to each other, right? And so they took two cans, poked holes in the bottom of them, and put a string and tied it, and then strung it and tied it that they could talk to each other to the cans.
Long before the cans and string, Paul and Fran were eager to start their family. And after years of waiting, they welcomed their first daughter, Jackie.
We always wanted kids, and nothing was happening. with spending, 8 years without children. We were tested, we were checked, everything was okay, blah, blah, blah. Everything we tried, and nothing worked. And so then she went to this one eye, nose, and ear doctor, that's what they called them, and found that she had a spur and up in her sinus area. So she had to get operated on this. They had that removed. And lo and behold, she got pregnant. Wasn't that amazing? Oh, getting an operation in your nose and you get pregnant, boom. The first daughter was named Jacqueline Ray. She's born in August 67. When she was born, my wife had a lot of complications because she was a diabetic. She had glaucoma. It seemed like she got everything wrong with her, but she hung in there and she was doing good. And Jackie was born. And that was like we were 8 years of, you can do anything you want. You can buy anything you want, right? And all of a sudden, bingo, we got a baby, coming through the door. Then everything changed, Everything's about the baby.
Then just 3 years later, they were able to adopt their second daughter, Nicole.
We always wanted to adopt, so we put in for adoption. We couldn't do it when she was a little baby. So Jackie was going on 3 years old at that time. And all of a sudden, she got pregnant again. Okay, then we had to stop the adoption. So then she had a miscarriage in the meantime. So we started back up again. Well, they checked you out, everything about you. They wanted to know everything. They checked your neighbors and everything about who you are, if you're good or anything. And so then we went to look at this new baby that was born. In 1970, September, she was so beautiful, like the Gerber baby. We said, we want her, we want her. She's a baby. So, okay, took her and she had cradle cap. And my wife got rid of that right away because of the person or whoever's taking care of her for the small amount of time. She ended up with the cradle cap. We named her Nicole. And so then we took her over to Aunt Katie and Uncle Matt's house, which Grandma LaBella was there and also Grandpa LaBella was there. They just loved the baby. And actually, the grandmother was blind, and she just felt her face. And she said she's beautiful. She couldn't see her, but she felt her face, and that was something.
It was around the time of Nicole's arrival that Paul decided it was time to make a career change.
I got tired of the red tape at the UW. Plus that, I wanted to upgrade to a different mainframe because the CPU time was getting close to 100%. I knew this guy at DOT. He was the director of the IT people. So then I called Mike Bacon up and I said, hey, Bacon, you got an opening out there at DOT at all? Yeah, yeah. Said, do you want to hire me? And so then I went out there and became the shift supervisor. And that's what I was a manager. I had more authority due to diversity, being over tons of people and making sure things are running right. But over here, I just had one shift to worry about, I've been there ever since, been through a lot of upgrading or many, many different types of mainframes. And so it's kind of neat.
There are many happy memories from the growing up years of the Irving girls, but most of them involve swimming and celebrating holidays with family.
We had a lot of birthday parties, of course, and a lot of girls sleeping over, a lot of sleepovers with girls, and they both swam on swimming teams. And first they started at West Side Club across the street. Then they wanted to continue on, so we went to the Y, and then we joined a actual swimming club in Madison, which is Madison Aquatic Club. So then they got really good at swimming and competed all the way through high school, then college, all the way through college. They swam practically all their life and was competing. They went to Odana School right up the street, and somebody set that place on fire. And Jackie was in the third grade, and Nicole was in the first grade at that time. Then they both went to West High School and graduated there and swam on the high school team besides belonging to the private club still, USA, the swimming club. Jackie got a scholarship at UW swimming. Everybody loved Jackie. All the swimmers, they all loved their guys, you know, too. They, you know, they liked her. You know, I mean, she wasn't one word, oh, I'm the best swimmer, because she was great. But I mean, she wasn't that type of a person. So everybody be hanging on her and everything and want to talk to her. She had a lot of boyfriends on the teams, different teams too, that she was a very strong swimmer and she could swim distance. She swam 10,000 meters without stopping. Yes, she was 14 years old, and then she came in third nationally on that. And then Jackie actually went to work for the state at the World Dairy. She entered the data for the pig testing of swine flu and stuff like that, that the doctors would do the testing. And you know, she's making good money, but good benefits and everything too. So then another company wanted her, and then she went because, you know, she had two kids. She is a great mom, and she is a great person. Nicole was in high school, was on track too. She's at hurdles in track, the 300 and the 100. She was a good hurdler. She came in second in the state in the 300, you know. And that day that she did, we were in another location where we had the conference. That day she did the prelims on the 100. And she was seated third on the 100. Then she fell. Her toe hit one of them and nearly banged her up. She was seated second in the 300. In the state meet. And we weren't even there yet. We had a drive to get there. So we got there. Where's Nicole? The doctors, they said, you're not going to be able to run. She said, oh, yeah, I am. I'm seated second. I'm running. And set him a gun if she didn't place second. She still got second damaged. And then Nicole, academically, she was solid as can be. So she had the Italian scholarship. Then she won the Spanish scholarship at West High School. She was a 4.0 student all the way. I mean, just even through college. I mean, PhD, 4.0s all the way through. Her motor runs fast, too. I mean, she always was that way, but she runs it 100%. And just a solid mother, good at everything. Christmases and all that was family, family, family. We had a great time. Played games all the time, too. And, of course, we have relatives all the time. At Christmas time, we're over at Grandma and Grandpa's house celebrating quite a lot. We had our tree, too, and stuff like that. But that's where we celebrated. We'd actually go, everybody would go to Christmas or Easter or whatever. Whatever holiday, it was at somebody's aunt's house or our grandparents' house or something like that. We would actually go there for Christmas Day. We'd leave there Christmas Eve. We'd eat and all that stuff like that. And then they have to stop because we're going to go to church midnight mass. You know, everybody go to midnight mass. So then after midnight mass, then we come back and the uncles or somebody would make Italian sausages and all kinds of food, played games, played cards, just had a lot of fun, you know, just like. And then, so we all go home at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then we come back the next morning for Christmas Day. Then we have the big meals, play cards and all kinds of stuff. So pretty tight family.
And of course, the joy of Paul's life has been spending it with Fran and doing all sorts of fun things together.
She was a beautiful person, really. She was a great mom. She was very attentive. We did a lot of things. We bowled. I think when I quit bowling, I think I was a 175, 180 average at that time. When my wife and I, we used to go bowling all the time, too. So we did that, and her dad, his wife, and my wife, me, we'd always go fishing about every night. Catching 100 fish at a time, come home, bluegills, perch, and have to fillet them, skin them and fillet them, and freeze them, divide them up. So it was kind of fun. We did that many, many, many times, going fishing. We've been fishing about every day, really. For a long, long time. When I retired, we went a lot of places, but out of the state, Iowa, for gambling, at Diamond Joe's, and we had gambling on a boat. She liked to go there. Before that, we did a lot of cruises. When I retired from the state in 1990, that was our first cruise, and that was only a 4-day cruise. And it was the Caribbean. Then we went to the 7-day, And we liked that better. It went further out, Martin Islands and stuff like that. That was kind of nice, real nice. And then we did Hawaii, went to Hawaii and did the cruise of all the islands there.
Sadly, and all too soon, on November 3rd, 2023, Frances passed away.
What happened was she fell in the bathroom. I think she lost her balance. It fell against the bathtub outside. She grabbed the curtain and went onto the edge of the bathtub, and she broke 5 ribs. We didn't know that she broke any ribs at that time. I said, I'm going to take an emergency. Oh, no, I don't want to go. Okay. I'll put the heating ice pack first. Ice it. I was icing it and gave her some Tylenol. And she went to bed. No problem. Seemed like she was okay. Then I said, well, I'm going to get you a bigger heating pad. And it was black and blue all the way down her leg, on that side also. And so I says, okay, you're not going to emergency, but you got a physical on Wednesday. This happened on a Friday night. She was comfortable. We did church on the TV instead of going to church. But other than that, she was getting up and everything. I had no complaints about really pain. She went for the physical, came back. I didn't know anything yet. At 9 o'clock on Wednesday night, we're talking from Friday to Wednesday, she had the broken ribs, right? Found out, and doctor calls it, you better take her down to emergency because I think she broke some ribs. I don't know how many. So I said, well, she's in bed sleeping right now. It's 7 o'clock at night, and she went to bed. So I said, I'll take her in the morning when she says her rosary and eats her breakfast. And I said, I'll do it that time. And that's what I did. And I waited till Thursday morning and took her into emergency and found out that she broke 5 ribs, but they don't take trauma patients. So she had to go over to UW. So they got to go to UW emergency. They took her in an ambulance and got her over there, went through the same routine, and they had to wait for a room for her after they found out. They looked at the x-rays too, and they said, we're going to admit her. She's got 5 broken bones there, so cracked or whatever it was. All of her stats were fine. Your pulse or heart or blah, 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 or lungs. And so they entered her finally into a room. And she was doing fine. They hooked her up to everything, monitors and all that, and everything looked good. And I kissed her goodbye. I had to leave at 9:30. I said, I really wanted to stay. No, you can't stay. Sorry. They close at 9:30. So then I said, I'll be back in about 6 o'clock or 6:30 in the morning. I'm going to stop at work, and then I'll be in at 6:30. So I got there the next morning, and there was doctors all over her. I said, what the heck is going on here? I left my wife. I kissed her goodbye. She was fine and dandy, right? And all of a sudden, she's going dormy on here. I said, wait a minute. So then they had to enter her into intensive care. Then they actually had to put the air oxygen thing down her throat because she couldn't get rid of the CO2, and her stats were looking good. And then they said, well, it looks like they're going to make it. They're, you know, they're getting rid of the CO2. I think she's going to be able to hold it. So we'll take that out tomorrow morning. I said, great. So then I come back the next morning. And so they took it out and everything was holding. And 2 hours later, no, it started building up again. So they went to CPAC. So they tried that, got it back to the same thing again. Hey, looks like she's going to be okay. They're over stats are fine. And so then they took it off the next morning. 2 hours later, nope, back again. Tried it again. And then I think we tried it 3 times. By that time, she was completely exhausted, you know, laying in bed all this time. She got only up once, twice. My daughters were there this time. And when I got back, she was back in the bed. And my daughter said they had to use the gurney to get her back in bed because she couldn't even stand. So then it got to be a never-ending thing. Then she said, I think I'm going to die. So we have a meeting with the doctors.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then her ranch that was in Africa, she got to see him. And then a photo, you know, phone call. Got to know about the great-granddaughter also. And when she found out that, and we were there, pray all the time, you know. And I always pray for my wife. And I know she's there.
Since Fran's passing, Paul has stayed positive and busy. He's still working, he keeps their house in tip-top shape, and of course spends time with his beautiful family.
Your mother and me, we loved you, and stood up for you all the time and made sure you're brought up right, correctly, and get a good education. And we loved our grandkids immensely, as you all know. Just keep good. And if when you're on your job, always give it 150%, not 100. And that's what I always preach to my grandkids, too, that get to the 150. Then you're going to do good, and you'll feel good with yourself that you did that. And don't get in trouble. Be good people.
As you've heard, Paul Irvin has lived a life of dedication, hard work, and happiness. He's a born problem solver and go-getter. He's a loving son, brother, husband, father, and grandfather, and has given his all to his family. A huge thank you to the Amari family for making this episode possible, and to Paul for being interviewed. If there's someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email us at hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.